Since this is for the fundraiser, I wonder, could you say just a word or two about the importance of supporting independent media like WBAI?
It's no secret that the media are becoming highly concentrated. The character and quality of news reporting and commentary, which was never much to brag about, is becoming more and more restricted. The opportunities for informing oneself and becoming an active participant in popular movements, or for that matter in a democratic society, are declining significantly, and that means that the independent media, sometimes called alternative media, are simply gaining even greater importance than they've had in the past, and are now almost fundamental to any real hope for a better future.
Oh, actually, along those lines, I'm just wondering if you could comment on the fact that your 9/11 book sold over 600,000 copies. We have people like Michael Moore, Greg Palast on the bestseller list. At the same time, you know, there's supposedly this grand consensus in support of the Bush administration and the war on terror. What do you make of this popularity, extreme popularity, of a lot of leftish or critical writing?
Well, that's just one aspect of a much broader phenomenon. Anyone who's available to give talks or take part in meetings or actions of one sort or another is simply overwhelmed by requests far beyond anything before. Audiences are huge and engaged. It's not just the current book lists, which are where the phenomenon of critical books, more or less from the left, very high, is quite new. That's never happened before. But it's much broader than that. The small publishers are republishing books from the 70s and the 80s, books that had a small audience then, but are being very much in demand today. I think there's it's very hard to comment on the mood of a country, but it's it is since 9/11. It has been very clear that there's much more concern, involvement, interest in finding out something about the world, skepticism about party line doctrine, standard doctrine, conventional views, and it takes all sorts of forms. At the same time, it's a very frightened country. Has been for a long time, long before 9/11. The current incumbents in Washington are basically recycled from the Reagan and first Bush administrations, and they maintained their hold on political power through those years simply by constantly pressing the panic button. Their policies weren't popular, they were harming the population, but they did succeed in frightening people. And in fact, this goes far back, and it's not unique to the United States. So there's a mixture of fear, concern, openness, extremism of various kinds. It's a very complicated situation. One manifestation is what you described, the appearance on the bestseller lists, really for the first time, of quite a group of books that are highly critical of prevailing ideology, of power systems and their nature and so on.
You mentioned the gang that's in power now, and in the run-up to the war about a year ago, Perry Anderson wrote a piece wondering why the present administration was bringing millions of people around the world into street protests when, to his view, what the Bush administration was doing was not all that different from what earlier U.S. presidents had done. How do you feel about this? Is this just more of the same, or is there some justification in this broad popular feeling that there's something different and more frightening about the present regime?
He's right that it's, in a sense, not off the spectrum, but it's at a very extreme end of a spectrum which is indeed rather narrow. And it's not just the millions of people in the streets. I can't remember a time when the mainstream foreign policy elite was so profoundly critical of government policy. I mean, you have to look very hard to find a time when journals like Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy or the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which never takes a political stand on anything, and other very mainstream institutions were extremely critical. Actually, when the war began last March, the harshest criticism that I saw was right in the mainstream. It was Arthur Schlesinger, writing in the Los Angeles Times, who said that the day of the bombing, he said he recalled President Roosevelt's remark at the day of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, that this was a date that shall live in infamy. And Schlesinger said, yes, the president was right, and today is another date that shall live in infamy, except now it is we Americans who live in infamy because we are following the policy of Imperial Japan as it set off on world conquest. Those are pretty strong words, and I can't remember ever hearing anything like that from within mainstream opinion, and that was not at all unique. The reasons were not just the invasion of Iraq. It was well understood, both in foreign policy elite circles and on the streets, that the invasion of Iraq was in large measure intended to illustrate that the doctrine of world domination that had just been announced was to be taken seriously. Remember how all of these things fell together. In September 2002, which was a very important month, the Bush administration released its national security strategy, which stated very openly and very brazenly that they intend to dominate the world by force if necessary, and to crush any perceived potential challenge to that domination. Within a few weeks, the most conservative and mainstream foreign policy journal, Foreign Affairs of the Council on Foreign Relations, published a major article by a leading international affairs specialist calling this a new imperial grand strategy and warning that on narrow grounds, but warning that it would be very harmful to the United States and the world. Well, when you announce that strategy is not without precedents. You can find precedents in the Clinton administration, Kennedy administration, in fact, back to World War II, but those were all more or less internal discussions or background commitments to use force if we ever had to. This was intended for public distribution. It was intended to be heard. It was a very extreme and brazen statement. And when you produce a doctrine and you want it to be taken seriously, you have to also carry out actions to show that you mean it. And the number of actions were immediately carried out to demonstrate to the world that we really mean what we're saying. The most dramatic of them was the invasion of Iraq, which was effectively announced in September 2002 at the same time as the national security strategy. It was also made very clear and explicit in terms that you couldn't miss that the invasion was going to be taken without any credible pretext and completely without international authorization or concern for international law and institutions. The UN Security Council was informed very explicitly that it could either be relevant, that's the term that was used, and endorse the actions that the United States was going to undertake anyway, or it could be a debating society, as Colin Powell described it. Those are its choices. Either endorse what we're going to do anyway, or just go off and have discussions among yourselves and be irrelevant. The invasion then followed without over overwhelming public opposition. Last December, the International Gallup poll reported its results from around the world, and they were startling. I don't think it was even published here, but the results were quite startling. They showed that I don't think there was a single country that they polled where support for the war that Bush had announced, namely a unilateral attack by the United States, independent of what anybody thought, that support for that barely reached 10% anywhere, which is pretty, and was much lower in most places. That's and that was reflected on the streets and in the elite commentary and so on, because it was recognized to be a dramatic new doctrine and the first overt war of aggression that had been carried out without any pretense that of any defensive or other concern. Schlesinger's comment, though extreme, was not inappropriate. That represents feelings across a very broad spectrum. Furthermore, that was not the only action. That was the most dramatic one. But 2 days after the announcement of the National Security Strategy, still September 2002, the Bush administration informed Europe that it was going to terminate negotiations on a a biological weapons convention. There were negotiations going on trying to put enforcement measures into weaker agreements on banning biological weapons, and the U.S. canceled that unilaterally. A couple of weeks later, at the United Nations, the U.S. Blocked efforts to an otherwise unanimous effort, the U.S. and Israel, but otherwise unanimous effort to reinforce a protocol going back to the 1920s, banning bacteriological warfare. And the U.S. also, once again, it's been going on for years, blocked efforts, otherwise unanimous, to ban the militarization of space. This is continuing. Just last December, when I said last December before, I meant 2002, but December 2003, the United Nations Disarmament Commission once again was blocked in its actions by U.S. refusal to permit reinforcement of a ban against militarization of space. Immediately after the National Security Strategy was announced, the Space Command announced released its plans for the coming years, which were quite dramatic, and I don't doubt that every intelligence agency in the world paid serious attention to them. They announced that the United States was going to move from control of space to ownership of space. That's consistent with the National Security Strategy. No competitors are permitted. We own it. Now, ownership of space means ownership of the capacity to carry out policies which they described and which in part had already been announced, namely placing platforms in space that can be used for highly destructive offensive weapons, which can strike any place on Earth almost instantaneously without warning. They have also announced the plans for extensive global surveillance with sophisticated measures, hypersonic drones and so on, that will theoretically provide instantaneous intelligence as to whether somebody's walking across a street in Madrid, or very precise information. What that amounts to, if you put it together, is a declaration that the U.S. is planning to have an offensive military capacity of extremely high destructive power, presumably including nuclear weapons, which can strike anywhere instantaneously without without warning, in accord with the announced strategy of dominating the world by force and preventing any potential challenge to that. Actually, this doctrine even became more extreme after the invasion of Iraq. As everyone knows, the invasion forces were unable to discover the alleged weapons of mass destruction that were the pretext for the invasion. And there's much discussion about deception, faulty intelligence, and so on. But there's a much more important consequence of the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction, in my opinion. The more important consequence is that it led to a change in the security doctrine, national security doctrine. The original doctrine stated that the U.S. would have the right to use military force at will to prevent the further development of weapons of mass destruction on the part of a potential challenger to the United States. Well, they didn't find weapons of mass destruction, so the doctrine was changed. Now it is the U.S. proclaims the right to use military force against anyone who need not have programs of weapons of mass destruction, but who has the intention and ability to create weapons of mass destruction. You'll notice that Colin Powell's latest justifications of his fabrications of the United Nations are that even though they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, they had the intention and the capability to develop them, and therefore it's legitimate to attack them. Well, just think what that doctrine means. Who has the ability to develop weapons of mass destruction? Just about any high school chemistry laboratory. Who has the intention to develop? Well, there's no way to determine that. That's whoever Washington claims has the intention. So the new doctrine, refined as a result of the failure to discover weapons of mass destruction, is to extend the threat to the world. You don't, even if you don't have any programs, just because you're a minimally industrialized society and therefore have the capacity, or because we say you have the intention, that's enough of a justification for us to attack you. There's no real surprise at the global reaction that this is eliciting, which incidentally continues. It's not just connection with the Iraq war. So just a few weeks ago, there was a poll, a European poll, which asked people how they ranked various threats to peace. The United States was ranked right at the top, alongside of North Korea and Iran, all the same, 60% or something like that. In fact, the only country, the only threat that was placed higher than the United States was Israel. Now, that's misleading, because Israel alone is not a threat. It's a small country. But Israel, backed by the United States, is a serious threat. And I think what that poll shows is worldwide concern that the U.S. is a major threat to peace, maybe very much like what Arthur Schlesinger declared. Even more recently, there was a poll in Latin America, just actually days ago, revealing, I don't remember the exact numbers, but opposition to U.S. policies was simply overwhelming. I think it was somewhere in the order of 85% to 90%. And in some countries, I think Mexico is one, it reached into the high 90s. Attitudes like that are really without precedent.
Well, the more sophisticated members of our foreign policy elite are, of course, alarmed by that kind of thing. But also, given the objections that you described from very elite orthodox people, how has the Bush administration been able to get away with it? Why haven't they been reined in?
Well, I think they haven't been reined in for several reasons. On the part of the general population, they haven't been reined in because they have succeeded in imposing fear. This is a frightened country. It's not hard to get people terrified, and they have succeeded in doing that. I mean, the most recent polls of American public opinion show a very high percentage of the population, I think it's maybe in 70% or something like that, who still believe that Iraq was developing weapons of mass destruction and had relations to Al-Qaeda and such terrorist groups, and maybe was even involved in 9/11. Well, you know, that's so far off the spectrum, it's hard to comment on it, but it is a very widely held belief, and people are very frightened and afraid to do anything. That's among the general public. But what about among the elites themselves, who are deeply concerned about the Bush's policies? And that's not just foreign policy elites, it's also business elites. You recall at the World Economic Forum last January, the Davos Conference, which is essentially the people who own the world, they were so antagonistic to the planned war in Iraq and to the security strategy that when Colin Powell attempted to defend it, he was practically shouted down. So why are they supporting the Bush administration? Well, that's not hard to answer, I don't think. The Bush administration not only has an international program, it also has a domestic program. And the domestic program is very welcome to narrow sectors of power and privilege that don't care much about the future, but care very much about enriching themselves and increasing their own power in the short run. I mean, after all, the administration policy is simply to lavish gifts on them while unraveling and dismantling the progressive achievements of popular struggle and legislation over the past century. They've essentially dismantled the tax system, approximately have a flat tax now at the federal level, pretty close to it. And the recent Medicare bill is, you know, an open gift to the pharmaceutical corporations, the insurance corporations, the HMOs, and so on, and introduces, takes another step towards dismantling Medicare, which is plainly what they're intending to do. They're going to move the same way on Social Security if they can get away with it. They'll try to dismantle the school system, privatize it, and so on. Progressive taxation is a thing of the past. Such measures are extremely welcome to the corporate sector, the extreme wealth and power. And even if they're deeply concerned about Bush's the long-term effects of Bush's programs and the dangers they cause, those gifts buy a lot of support.
Those gifts also cost a lot of money, and the Bush administration's adventures are heavily financed by foreign borrowing.
Yeah.
Certainly they're not making it any easy for themselves to borrow by being so rude in their treatment to the rest of the world. What about the fact that so much of this has to be put on credit? Are we seeing the imperial overstretch that we heard about 10, 12 years ago? Are there economic constraints on American military and imperial power?
It's very hard to say, actually. There was a brief but succinct but not inaccurate description of the global economy by Laura Tyson a couple of weeks ago, former chair of Clinton's Council on Economic Advisors. She said the world economy is one in which America spends and Asia lends. And there's a lot of truth to that. And I think the Bush administration assumes, maybe correctly, that Asian governments and very wealthy Asian entrepreneurs and corporate entities will continue to lend money to the United States because they benefit from it. And that may be true. And there's another factor which we shouldn't forget either. If Brazil were to default on its loans, they'd be in deep trouble. What would happen if the United States were to default on its loans or to eliminate them in some other means by currency manipulations? Can anybody do anything about it? I mean, the IMF has warned the United States that its current financial indebtedness and its deficit and so on are a huge problem to the world economy. Can they do anything about it? Can they impose structural adjustment programs on the United States as they would in the case of any other country? Of course not. The United States is simply too powerful. And they may feel, the Bush administration, that it really doesn't matter. One way or another, they will be able to continue the policies of dismantling whatever there is of a welfare state at home and dominating the world by force. And they'll either they'll be paid by foreigners because they'll be afraid, or they'll simply disregard them. Now, whether that's possible or not is another question. In fact, they're already having serious problems and are drawing back very visibly from the most extreme policies. I mean, take just Iraq. The invasion of Iraq, it was clear in advance, was going to be a walk in the park. I mean, Iraq, they would never have invaded Iraq if they hadn't known, as we all did, that Iraq was completely defenseless, the weakest country in the region. The army would probably collapse in a minute. What's astonishing is that it took more than 3 days. But the post-invasion situation has not gone the way they expected. They assumed, not without reason, that it ought to be one of the easiest military occupations in history. However, their combination of arrogance and ignorance has led to an outcome in which they simply can't control the situation, and they're backing off from their extreme policies. So one of the first policies, programs, illegal, but immediately and quickly announced by the Bremer administration in Iraq, was to open the country to essentially give away the economy of the country to foreign investors, also imposing ridiculously low taxes on the rich and so on. Well, they've had to back off from that. They can't quite carry that off. They had hoped to ram through their own program for imposing a governmental structure on Iraq. There's been enormous opposition within Iraq, and they've had to back down on that. We're now January 16th. This morning's lead story in the New York Times is about how under Iraqi pressure for a more democratic procedure, the CPA, the Bremer administration, is agreeing to approach the United Nations to try to give some kind of legitimacy or cover to a procedure which could be marginally, which would at least, as the press puts it, look more democratic. Well, they're backing away from their earlier arrogance and extremism because it's just too hard to manage. And this is true in case after case. If there has already been overstretch and therefore being compelled to back down, but how far it'll go, one doesn't know. They have enormous resources of violence at their command. If they have another mandate to exercise their political programs, they could lead to outcomes that could be extremely harmful. I mean, look, this last week in the Journal of the American Association for Advancement of Science, the Journal of Science, there's an important report by the leading scientific advisor to the British government on environmental affairs, well-known scientist, on the consequences of the expected, they've completed studies on the expected consequences of global warming for the world, but primarily for England, and they're pretty drastic. And he points out, the author, politely, that unless the U.S. government reverses course on this, there could be a major disaster. That's well known to scientists. There's not much disagreement about that. It's a very serious danger. but the Bush administration is paying no attention, and a good part of the corporate sector doesn't care either. And from their point of view, they're more or less correct. And after all, the institutional framework in which they work says that you should not be concerned with long-term outcomes. You should try to maximize profit and market share tomorrow. If you don't do that, you're not going to be able to succeed in a partially competitive, oligopolistic economy. So therefore, what happens in the long term is somebody else's business. And if it means destruction of the possibility for life on Earth, well, you know, it's not our problem, somebody else's problem. Or, you know, the market will take care of it, or some other mantra. In fact, it's quite remarkable to see the discussion that's going on right now, the last few days, about what's called Bush's grand vision of exploration of space. First of all, the idea that this is a grand vision is so comical, you can't even laugh at it. I mean, if I were to say, let's explore Alpha Centauri, would that be a grand vision? No, it would be idiocy. There's no vision involved. The program will undoubtedly be a major boon to Lockheed, Boeing, other parts of high-tech industry. But it is, if it's ever carried out, it'll be extremely costly. And just look at the commentary on it. The Wall Street Journal, my favorite comic strip, had an article a day or two ago saying this is a wonderful thing, we have to do it. It doesn't matter how much it costs, it'll be of enormous benefit to us. In fact, who knows, maybe an asteroid will hit the Earth and destroy the possibility for life here. And if we have managed to settle on Mars and so on, we'll be able to save human life. Well, you know, what's the probability of an asteroid hitting the Earth as compared with the probability of global warming making life virtually impossible for maybe hundreds of millions of people? I mean, they're not even comparable. And this is the same comic strip that is telling us we don't have to worry about global warming. But we do have to worry about maybe an asteroid will hit the Earth. So therefore, let's pour huge amounts of money into the coffers of high-tech corporations and enrich them even further. If somebody were looking at this from Mars, they wouldn't know what to say.
Well, the folks in the Daily Show say it's a proof that the Bush administration has just given up on life on Earth and is ready to move on. If we look at the polls, for example, that showed an enormous number of Americans believe that Saddam was somehow hooked up with 9/11, that he was somehow hooked up with Al-Qaeda. The number of people even believe that weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq, and even some people believe they were used in the war.
Yeah.
It makes you wonder just where people get their ideas from and whether it's all rational or whether there's a heavy dose of irrationality. Is it enough to just try to fact-check the stuff that people read and hear and believe? Is it enough just to get the facts out there, or is there something else that has to be done? Is there some sort of tenacious psychological reasons why people believe things that are just nonsensical?
I think both. First of all, it is extremely important to get the facts out there. One of the major studies, there's a very interesting study on exactly this question by the best polling agency in the world, the most serious one, the Program on International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. They did a study called Misimpressions of Iraq. And what they did was take various beliefs of the kind you mentioned, which are so extreme that no serious analyst in the world believes them. They took a number of those and asked people's attitudes, and commitment to those beliefs was extremely high. But then they went on, and they correlated these beliefs with the source of news. Well, it turned out that people who were getting their information from Fox News, I think about 80% of them had very serious misimpressions of the kind you mentioned. If they were getting them from the print press, you know, New York Times, I think it was on the order of 50%. If they were getting their information from NPR, Misimpressions, serious misimpressions, were in the order of 25%, which is appalling enough. And this doesn't count another part of the population. This doesn't count the 20 to 25% of the population that's getting their news from talk radio, or a very substantial part of the younger population, which is literally getting their information about the world from these comic shows that go on in the evening on television. That tells you a lot about where people's information's coming from. So yes, getting information across is extremely important, crucial. Is it enough? No, because there are other factors. The fear that is endemic in the United States is a very dangerous phenomenon, and it goes far back. It's not just the Bush administration or the Reagan administration, which stayed in office just by terrifying people over one thing or another every year. It goes much farther back than that. When my kids were in elementary school around 1960, they were literally being taught to hide under desks to protect themselves from atom bombs. I mean, aside from the lunacy of the idea, I don't think there was any other place in the world where there was an effort being made to frighten children into the belief that they'd be under nuclear attack. You go back to the First World War. During the First World War, this was a pretty pacifist country. People did not want to, did not see any reason to become involved in an internal European struggle among imperial powers, and it was quite a sane reaction. Woodrow Wilson wanted desperately to get into that war. He created the first state propaganda agency, and within a few months, they had turned the country into raving anti-German lunatics who so extreme that the Boston Symphony Orchestra couldn't play Beethoven. And it's not unique to the United States. The United States may be extreme in this respect, but it's certainly not alone. I mean, take a look at Germany. Germany, remember, in the 1930s, Germany was the peak of Western civilization. In the arts, in the sciences, in literature, it was the absolute peak. Hitler very quickly succeeded in turning the population into, first of all, terrifying them by the fear of the attack that was being carried out against them by the Jews and the Bolsheviks and so on, and then leading them into some of the worst atrocities of human history. These things can be done, and we should be worried about them. And that means approaching the problem at many different levels. First, getting information across, that's really important, but also dealing with the background issues, the background problems that do exist and can't be overlooked.
All right, thank you very much for your time.